This is Roland Chidiac Connects, a podcast about motivation and inspiration. Ever wonder what drives people to do what they do? Join me as I connect with a variety of people who have great stories to tell about what inspires them, ignites their passions, and leads them to make a difference in their work and the people around them. This is episode 39 of Roland Chidiac Connects, the podcast about motivation and inspiration. And this evening, I'm happy to welcome Emily Gover to the podcast. Emily and I met over a year ago when I was surfing the net. I got a Twitter notification, something like that. And I was on a list. And it was the top 51 gaffe gurus on Twitter. And the first thing I thought when I realized I was on this list was somebody made a huge mistake. So eventually I connected with Emily and I'm honored. I'm still honored because I do not consider myself a gaffe guru, not at all. And so we connected, and next thing you know, I'm having a Google Hangout with Emily and we're talking about how I could possibly create some content with her to place on the website of the company she worked for at the time, which was called Imagine Easy Solutions. And from that point forward, we followed each other on Twitter. I've had lots of back and forth with Emily on Twitter, Instagram. It's just great to connect with her, and she's a really easy person to talk to and has this wicked love for educational technology. So let me tell you a little bit more about her before I welcome her on the show. She's a marketer, a writer, a librarian, and a proud nerd. I told her I would include that. As a writer, she has been published in the Huffington Post, the School Library Journal, and other places. Also, as I said earlier, she's wicked, totally into ed tech. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that and what she's up to these days. I find her to be just a really cool human, easy to talk to, high-level thinking. You can go deep with her. So I'm hoping we get a little bit of that this evening. And if we don't, that's okay too. It's just a real pleasure to talk to her. Emily, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Roland. I'm so glad to be here and I'm excited to talk with you again because it has been a while since we conversed in more than 140 characters, I think.
Right on. Yeah. So when I was kind of writing out a list of people I wanted to talk to, and the list keeps growing, right? Like it never stops because there's so many amazing people that I'm kind of connected with or just exposed to. And I never knew that you were into podcasts, but I had read that somewhere that you were like, podcasts are your thing. You enjoy them. You're into them. How long has that been going on?
So podcasts are definitely my thing, so to speak. I wrote about them a fair bit more on my blog when I had more time to do that. But I've probably been listening to podcasts for a good 7 or 8 years now. It started when I was in graduate school and I was going to school full time in upstate New York in Albany. But I had my first library job was part time and was down in my hometown, which is about 30 miles outside of New York City. So there's about a 2.5 hour gap between these two places that I was shuttling back and forth from. And I have very low patience for constantly toggling the radio only to listen to the same top 40 pop songs. And I love a good pop song, but there's only so many times I can hear even Justin Bieber. So I started listening to podcasts because I could download them on my iPod because that was a thing that I had 7 years ago. And you didn't have to worry about losing reception or anything like that. And you could listen to maybe two podcasts and I'd be home. So that was sort of how it all started. And then it just kind of snowballed from there into a very happy obsession.
Cool. Can you tell us a little bit about, well, you've been on a couple of podcasts, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What did you talk about on those podcasts?
So they've both been ed tech related. I've been on two podcasts. One is On the Vendor Floor with Melissa Emler, which was sort of a passion project that she had kicked off in, I think, 2016, shortly before I left my previous job, which you mentioned before, Imagine Easy Solutions. And then in this past fall, I was on two episodes of The House of EdTech with Chris Nessie. I'm sorry, Chris, if you're listening. May have butchered his last name. But so on those two episodes, we talked about one was on audio and education, where I sort of rambled on about my love for podcasts for a good 45 minutes. And Chris was very gracious to listen to me yabber on. And then the other one I did was with my friend Steve Isaacs, who I am involved with the EdTech Bridge Twitter community. So we talked about building community in the EdTech space, which I think you and I have experience in firsthand, because that was how we met.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me, this passion for EdTech, where did it come from?
Sure. So my background is in libraries. And when I was in grad school, I was constantly looking for ways to invest more time in my schoolwork that made it a little bit more efficient without sacrificing like the quality of my learning experience or the output of my work, which was when I started to learn about tools that like education technology tools that could help me with that. And one of them was EasyBib.com, which was the company that I ended up working for 4 years. And I learned about EasyBib when I was in grad school. I went on to work as an academic librarian in rural Northwest Georgia for a short while. And then my friend told me about a job at EasyBib that had opened up. And I was just so excited to work for this company that was helping students build their information literacy skills and helping librarians free up their teaching time, because no longer they have to teach about, you know, periodical titles need to be italicized and things like that. So that was sort of how it started, was just my own experience using EasyBib. And then when I was working there at Imagine Easy Solutions, which is the company that at the time owned EasyBib, I learned about all of these other tools just through working with the librarians and teachers that used our product. They would say, well, can you integrate with this? And what about this tool? And have you tried using this tool with EasyBib? And I just saw this whole new world of how teachers were, they had great ingenuity in using different types of technology to help their students learn and to make it more fun. And that was just very inspiring to me, which is sort of how I got hooked on it, because I was just hungry to see how else teachers could use tech to support learning.
I'm very interested in asking you about your graduate studies. Did you study, like, was it library studies that you did in graduate school?
Yeah, so the degree was a master's in information science, with a concentration in library and information services. So I think had I gone to this school maybe 15 years prior, it would have still been library science, but they've added a lot more of like a technical aspect to a lot of these library science programs. So the name has shifted to information science, but the gist of it was library school.
In the last few years, I've discovered this whole new role that the librarian has in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And it's come from my friends in the United States who are teachers but have moved into the library. And the things they're doing are amazing, like a lot of the tech integration stuff, a lot of the maker spaces, a lot of the 3D printing. It seems to be like growing and coming from that area. And I'm really sad because in my school district, a long time ago, we used to have teacher librarians, mm-hmm. but eventually some districts phased those out and have brought in library technicians to kind of run the library and help out in the school. But I really think like that would have been, that job today would be something that I'd be so interested in doing. Whereas, you know, traditionally my friends who have gone into library sciences have always been just like book lovers and wanted to be surrounded by books. Now that the whole tech thing, the maker spaces is all coming out and fresh, and the whole learning commons concept. I see those people struggling a little bit, mm-hmm. but I see my friends who are like innovative types, ed tech types, they're going into it and they're loving every minute of it. So I really think it's cool. I've got this new respect for librarians that, not to say I disrespected them before, I just didn't have the same kind of respect that I have now. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool to talk to someone like yourself who has a history with it. And how cool is it that you went from using a product to working for the company that makes the product?
Yeah, well, that was so exciting for me. And I think it made my job a lot easier. I started out there writing curriculum, but I sort of, I mean, as librarians do, like you were just saying, Roland, they wear a lot of different hats and they juggle a lot of different roles in the school. And my role at EasyBib when I joined, when we were very small, was kind of similar, where I did a lot of different things. So I started out writing curriculum. I transitioned into marketing. And it's very easy to market a product that you yourself use and love and believe in. And I don't know if there are too many companies out there where their marketing team employees can say that, but I've been fortunate in that both roles that I've held in the ed tech space, I have been very excited and passionate and truly just love the product itself. So I think that kind of comes through in the work that I do in my day to day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you were working for Imagine Easy, mm-hmm. and I have to tell you that when I heard from you that you were going to be moving and going somewhere else, I was a little bit sad, and I'm not sure why, because I had connected with you through that route, mm-hmm. and it doesn't even make any sense because it's not like you've left Twitter or anything. You're still same place online, but I was just like, oh no, because I think it's because we had worked so well together. Writing some posts, and I felt like the work I was doing was being acknowledged. And I know it kind of sounds funny, but when you're a primary teacher and you're big into ed tech and your kids are doing some neat stuff, people don't really care. Like, and I kind of feel bad even saying that. I think the biggest bang for the buck is like, you know, older kids. People don't think of primary students, for the most part, as being able to churn out the things that they can churn out and the creativity that they can have and the content they can create. So I really want to thank you for kind of helping me along that journey, because I learned a lot and I built what I believe is a really cool foundation that's helped me now teaching junior grade students, so grade 4 and 5. So when I found out you were moving, I was sad, but it's all good because you're still around. And now you're working for Flowcabulary. Can you tell us what you do for them?
Sure. Well, before I go into Flowcabulary, I just want to say, Roland, one reason why we put you on that Twitter list that you were talking about at the beginning of this podcast was because of the fact that you were a primary school educator and you were using EdTech, specifically Google Apps for Education tools. Because you're right, that's not something that you see a lot out there in the Twitter sphere, and you see a lot in middle school, high school, secondary grades. And that was one reason why we featured you on the list and why I was so excited to work with you. And I know, too, that other educators who saw the articles that you generously wrote and we published on the blog, they loved that because there wasn't a ton of content out there. So the pleasure was all mine, really. And I think, you know, you're continuing to do great work with that. So as for Flowcabulary, we are a K-12 education platform. And essentially what we are is Schoolhouse Rock, but with hip hop, or if you're familiar with Hamilton, the musical, we're sort of like Hamilton, but for all grade levels and all subject areas. So Flowcabulary has actually been around for about 14 years, maybe. Is that right? Yeah, I think around 13 or 14 years. It evolved from our co-founders doing live performances at schools to landing a record deal, I guess, for lack of a better term, and created some CDs, and then they created some books. And for a long time, they were selling books and CDs out of the trunk of their car. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, they launched a web app where they uploaded all of the songs into a online library. And now they've created animated videos that go along with all of them. And we have over 800 educational hip hop videos. And if your listeners have never heard Flowcabulary, they might think it sounds kind of kitschy or gimmicky, but I encourage them to go to our website and watch one of our free videos, because these tunes get stuck in my head for like days at a time. And I'm not even kidding when I say that.
And so how do you help them with their mission?
Sure. So I actually, yesterday was my 1 year anniversary there, which is a little
congrats. Bonkers.
Thank you. Thank you. Time flies when you're having fun. I am the director of content marketing there. So I help our community manager oversee our community efforts with our end users. So we recently launched our community ambassador program called the Flowcabulary MC Educators. And in addition to that, I oversee our blog content strategy, and I coordinate our presence at conferences. And then I also do some document creation, so to speak, for our sales team and our customer success team. So if we need to create a handout or a flyer for our customers that would help them better understand how Flowcabulary works or how they can use it, I help with the writing for that as well. So definitely wear a lot of hats, but I tend to gravitate towards those kind of roles anyway, it seems. So it's definitely been a whirlwind for sure.
Yeah, like the whole creativity portion comes up. Like you do a lot of creative stuff,
yeah.
I feel like.
Yeah, and I feel like I did this a fair bit at EasyBib too. And the marketing team at Flowcabulary right now is a little bit smaller, so we haven't had as much bandwidth to contribute to that as much as I would like, but we're getting there. And even if I'm not, I can express creativity through blog posts that we're writing or webinars that we want to put on or fun things that we want to coordinate at conferences. So one thing we do at a lot of our conferences is we almost always have one of our rappers with us. And so we will do live performances at the booth. And even if that's not something that I can do, because as much as I love a good karaoke session, I am not a rapper, despite what I like to tell myself. And even then, I can just appreciate being around creative people and creative minds. And there are a ton of them at Flowcab, which is great.
So can you tell us, like, I'm a grade 4 or 5 teacher, so what would Flowcabulary do for me, or how could I use what you offer to help my students learn?
Sure. So we have a ton of content available for upper elementary students. And again, we cover all grades and subject levels. So we actually just put some out recently on static electricity, which are quite fun. So teachers can search either by standard. We have all of our videos aligned to state and certain national standards. And they can also just browse by subject area, or they can search by certain keywords. And once you find a unit that you're interested in, we have what we call the Flowcabulary instructional sequence, which is 3 phases. It starts with engagement, where you watch the video, you play it in class, and you can do a search for Flowcabulary on Twitter, and you will find pictures and videos of kids standing up on their seats in the classroom, singing along, dancing, having the best time as they learn about, you know, point of view or what poetry is or different types of rocks. So the first phase is engagement. The second step is mastery. So with every unit, we include things like assessments, reading passages, writing activities, annotated lyrics, so students can sort of dive deeper into the content that we cover in the video. And then the last step of the Flowcab instructional sequence is create. So last September, we launched a feature called Lyric Lab, where students can actually write their own educational raps using key terms that we pull from the song and from the unit so that they can sort of demonstrate what they've learned and tell it in their own words and then perform it to a Flowcabulary beat. So it sort of comes full circle where they start by watching an educational rap. They learn all about the concepts and skills being covered, and then they get to write about it themselves. And if their teacher wants, they can perform it too.
I think it's totally wonderful. As somebody who can appreciate or have appreciated hip hop, I know exactly what you're talking about. Years ago, I met a teacher in the public district here in my city mm-hmm. who was putting together raps to the science curriculum.
Awesome.
And I remember him and I worked on this committee, and the one day before the committee meeting, I saw him in the parking lot. I'm like, tell me more about this. He's like, come to my car. And we literally sat in his car for 10 minutes before the meeting, listening to his rap. And he had, like, it was awesome just to see how pumped he was about it. He was telling me about the student engagement. We're talking, this is like 8 or 9 years ago. So this was still, like, Flowcabulary was around. But to the normal people around us, he was the crazy dude. But like, wow, just what a way to get kids on board. What a way to teach them. Anyway, long story short, I think it's fantastic. I remember bothering you, maybe less, I don't know. You were into your job and I just said something like, do you guys cover Canadian curriculum? Mm-hmm. And the answer was no at the time.
Sadly.
And well, I'm just thinking now, why would you? You've got this thing going on in the United States, so why would you include us Canadians in there? But I think it would be cool. I know I'm going to go back and look at some of your free videos, and I want to see what's up. I want to check this out, and I think other people will as well when they hear about it. So thanks for explaining what you do. I don't know how you do your job. Like, I have a hard time seeing myself doing anything outside of education. I know when I'm talking to people and they're like, hey, you've got some great ideas. Why don't you try to be an entrepreneur? I'm like, no, thank you. I like that. I like my job. I like that it's steady and there's no real ups and downs. And I think my wife might kill me if I tried something like that. But anyway, I think it's cool what you're doing. You live in New York City?
Yes, that's correct. So I worked when I was at EasyBib. We were based in Midtown Manhattan. So we were steps away from the New York Public Library and Bryant Park and Empire State Building and Times Square. We were really in the heart of it. And Flowcabulary is actually based in Brooklyn, in a neighborhood where a lot of the Brooklyn startups are based, called Dumbo. Sadly, there are no elephants around. But it's a beautiful place to work. It's a very small neighborhood that's going on under a lot of sort of redevelopment, so to speak. And most of the buildings, including my office building, is a converted factory. The cardboard box was actually invented in Dumbo, apparently.
Wow.
So there's a lot of these old factory buildings that have been converted into ridiculous luxury apartments and all these beautiful cobblestone streets, and you're right by the water. So it's a very different pace compared to what I was used to when I was working at EasyBib, but I relish it because when I'm having a busy day at work, which is most days working in, I wouldn't say we're a startup, but we're definitely in a growth phase right now. And, I can just take a breather and I can go out and I can go for a 20-minute walk by the water and check out the Brooklyn Bridge and the Freedom Towers in the background. And I'm in awe of all of it. And it sort of grounds me a little bit. And it's like, okay, why am I getting wound up about my inbox having 30 unread messages when I have this like right in front of me to appreciate? So definitely try to make most of the neighborhood.
What's it like to live in New York City? Like, okay, so you were in the heart of the city before, the hustle and bustle, and now you're still there, but you're not in the depths of it. Tell me, I don't know why I'm fascinated about this city. What is it like living there and working there?
Yeah, it's pretty surreal at some points in time. I was very lucky in that I New York City was always in my backyard, so to speak, when I was growing up. And before that, before I moved to the New York area, I actually grew up in England. So I was constantly visiting London when I was a kid, and then we would come to visit my family in New York, and then we would go see the Christmas tree. So I've always been around these like large metropolitan areas. And when I got my first job out of library school, I mentioned that I moved to Georgia. And where I lived was maybe a 90-minute drive outside of Atlanta. And if you were to drive 90 minutes outside of New York City, there are still trains that you can take to get into Manhattan. And so I just had this very naive notion that that's exactly what it would be like when I moved to Atlanta. And needless to say, that was not the case. So New York City in and of itself is a very special place simply because you have 8 million people crammed into a very small space. And there's nothing really quite, there's no city quite like it in the States, I feel. And it's great fun, but it also gets pretty exhausting. I've lived here almost 5 years now. And, you know, I would go into the city all the time when I was living at home and when I was in grad school. But there's something about just being here all the time that you kind of realize, like, you don't really see animals besides pigeons. And I love birds, and I'm one of those people who actually likes pigeons, and I think they get a bad rap. But, you know, like, the only animals you see are, like, pigeons and then the occasional squirrel if you're near, like, a patch of grass. So there's pros and cons for sure, but, you know, there's so many great opportunities, and there's always something going on, but you also need to learn to kind of get out of the city too sometimes, because it's not reality, I think, for like a lot of people too. Like, it's not a normal thing to work 10-hour days and then stand on a super crowded subway platform and squeeze into a subway car and go home and go to a bar after work and pay $8 for a glass of wine. And that's a good deal. You know, like it's a very crowded and expensive place to live. But at this point I couldn't really see myself living anywhere else. So we'll see.
You mentioned that you're from England.
Yes. I don't have the cool accent though, sadly.
Well, that's okay. How long were you there, and when did you come over?
I was born there and I lived there until I was about 9. And then when I was entering fourth grade, I moved to the States, and I still have a lot of family in England. I'm actually going back in, two or three weeks, to visit them. So I've sort of, grown up on both sides of the Atlantic.
How do you not have an accent?
So my dad is a Brit and my mom is American. And when I moved back here with my mom and my sister, I wasn't around anyone with a British accent anymore. And I think I was at that age where I was just young enough to lose it. And my older sister also lost hers. So I think it was just because we weren't around British people. But you hear it on certain words sometimes, or I'll use a figure of speech that you don't really hear that much in the States, and people are like, why did you use that word? And then I realized, oh, I guess that's more of an English word than like an American English word. So.
Okay. That's cool. I didn't know that about you. So it's kind of neat to learn that. I feel privileged because I'm learning everything about you, but you don't know much about me. So it's kind of cool. And I'm going to keep that going by,
I'll have to start a podcast and interview you next time.
There you go. I could be your first guest, and then you'll never have another guest again. What? Because nobody's going to want to listen to your podcast.
No way. Not even close to being true.
Tell me, how did you do in school when you were a student?
I was a good student. I definitely, when I was in high school, I was not straight A's. I was a lot of B pluses. Some A minuses, and then the occasional A. I always strived and strived to do well in English, which is what I ended up majoring in college. So reading and writing has always been my strong suit, I think. And I always had like a hard time with math and science, I think, like a lot of girls do for whatever reason. And I was also really, I liked French. I was really into the whole French language thing, even if, you know, you asked me today, I couldn't string a sentence together. But I'd say English and French were probably my two big things.
Okay. And then when you went to university, did you always know what you wanted to do?
No way. Absolutely not. I applied to maybe 8 schools, and I had convinced myself that I wanted to go to a small private liberal arts college that had, you know, beautiful lush green lawns and looked like something out of a movie. And then I kind of had like a crisis when it came to deciding, because I didn't know where I wanted to go. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I ended up picking a large public university in the suburbs of Long Island outside of New York. And I picked it because they had so many different degree programs. And my first year, my freshman year there, I took linguistics and philosophy, psychology, biology, sociology. I didn't take the same subject twice for my first year. I just explored all different areas. And when it came down to it, I still just kind of felt like my passion was in reading and writing. And with an English degree, there's a lot of flexibility. You know, I do think sometimes people turn their nose up to it because, you know, they'll say like, oh, you're majoring in waitressing when you say that you're, you know, when you say that you're studying English. But I feel like it's a great degree that, you know, can set you up for law school or education or librarianship, publishing. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of flexibility there. And I definitely don't regret it, either majoring in English or staying at my school that I went to.
Okay, so at what point did you realize that you wanted to do a graduate degree around the whole librarian thing?
Yeah, so I graduated. I started my senior year of college in fall of 2008. And if for those of you who don't remember, that was not a great time for the American economy. So graduation, I was excited about it, but I was also not excited about it because job outlook was pretty bleak for most people, let alone recent graduates. So I had been talking about it with my mom, and I was thinking about looking into graduate programs. And I was considering law school, and I was considering publishing programs, because there's New York City is a big, you know, publishing, has a big publishing industry here. And so they have various degree programs, and I was looking into that. But then I was thinking about it and majored in English. I minored in journalism. And some of my favorite projects and assignments that I had when I was in college was when I would have to do research. And the librarian from my school would come in and show us how to use all these different databases and how to evaluate them for, you know, accurate sources and relevant sources. And it kind of struck me that it would be a great mix of things that I really loved doing. So I really, you know, I loved literature. And like you were saying, you have friends who are librarians who quote unquote love to be around books. And I am one of those people. Mm-hmm. But I also loved technology. And I had seen through working with a librarian at my college that there's a lot of technology involved with librarianship nowadays. And I also loved helping people. And librarians, when you meet the right ones, they are some of the most helpful people that you'll ever meet. So we have a few family friends who are librarians, so I had talked with them about whether it's sort of a right career path for me, and I just kind of researched a few different programs and went from there, and the rest is history, so to speak.
Awesome. So you were telling us a little bit earlier about being in New York City, the hustle and bustle.
Yep.
You're paying a lot of money for a glass of wine, which was a deal.
And everything else.
Right, exactly. Like, I guess it's all relative, right? When you're in New York City, it's all relative. Yeah. And okay, so you're going through all that, you're doing all that. I have to ask, what motivates you and inspires you to do the work you do as you have to go through all that? Like, what keeps you going?
Yeah, well, I was actually thinking about this before we started talking today, because sometimes I do feel, and this probably isn't just exclusive to New York City by any means, but people just kind of get into a routine, right? And they just kind of go through the motions, and then all of a sudden mm-hmm. you realize like, oh, 2 years have gone by at this job that I'm not really happy at. And that is not the case, for the record, how I'm feeling right now, but I can see how it's easy for people to kind of get sucked into that. And so I was thinking about it, and, you know, I sadly haven't worked in a library for about a year now, and I miss it, but I don't think I could ever, if I were to stay out of the library for the rest of my life, I don't think I would be able to work in an industry that's not education or library related, because what I love doing is working with those people, working with teachers like you and teachers who use Flowcabulary and librarians who were big fans of the EasyBib, and even those that are not fans of our products, and learning from them about why, what they're, you know, why they're averse to using our technologies and what we can do to make it easier for them. I just feel like teachers and librarians have such important jobs to do that if I'm not in their shoes, the least I can do is try to make their job more meaningful and worthwhile, whether it's working on a platform like Flowcabulary, where you have teachers telling stories about how this product has completely done a 180 in their classroom for students learning new words and vocab terms, to working with teachers like you, Roland, who say, you know, you published this blog post for me and now I'm getting recognition from my teachers. Like, you mentioned that a few minutes ago, but we've heard that too from teachers who have written for Flowcabulary's blog as well. And I just think anything that we can do to enable and empower teachers and librarians, it's worth doing. And I really think at its core, like, that's what's motivating me to do it. And at Flowcabulary too, our CEO and our entire leadership team are so driven by what impact we're making in the classroom, that I feel kind of inspired by them too, you know, because they're working just as hard as everybody else in the company. And every time a new video comes out, or we see a picture or a video on Twitter of a classroom, it just kind of bolsters that motivation that much more.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for thinking of us, the teachers and the librarians and the people in education, because, and I can say this about you, when you say that, I believe it's authentic, because I have a connection with you and I've known you for a while and I've gotten to work with you. And even though it's not been a face-to-face interaction, I've always gotten the vibe that you've cared about the work we're doing, because you're working to make it better for us. I mean, of course, I mean, you're getting paid, you work for a business, we get it. I get paid for my work too, right? So, but I mean, I really appreciate what you said, and I'm glad that it motivates you. I'm glad that it keeps you going, because we need people like you who can support us as we're trying our best to do new things, to do different things, to engage kids and help them learn. And we all know how busy teachers are. Like, I was talking to somebody today, and I was asked about certain products and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I basically said, like, I'm pretty open to trying new things. I consider myself an early adopter. But if I spend an hour of my weekend trying to make something work, and it's that difficult that I can't do it in an hour with all the resources I have at my fingertips, then I'm moving on. Right. Like, it doesn't matter to me what it is. I'm done, because I can't give up hours like that on things that are supposed to make my life easier, but they don't.
Yep.
And so it's appreciated. So thank you. The last major question I want to ask you, because I promised you I wasn't going to keep you on for an hour and a half, is what would you say to somebody to help them find their motivation or their inspiration?
Ooh, that's a tough question. You know, I would just encourage people to go out. I guess the first question is, like, if you're not happy in your job, figuring out what it is that you're passionate about. I know people say find what you're good at and find a way to make money off of that, and I don't necessarily think that's always the right move. But it's more about what you're passionate about, and I feel like everybody has things that they care deeply about and causes that they care deeply about. So I think pursuing that, whether it's through a job that helps you pay the bills or through volunteering that just gives you great satisfaction, exploring that and trying new things can really sort of open up new opportunities for you and new perspectives as well. I had tried volunteering at a couple different organizations over the years, and, you know, I would stick with them for a little while. And even if it became challenging to keep up with the volunteering, for example, because I would move I moved out of Manhattan, and it made it a little bit harder for me to get up to the Upper West Side from Queens. And most people listening probably don't know what that means, but it's like an eternity in subway travel time. And so even though I may not be volunteering at this one place that much anymore, I still learned so much, and it changed me. It changed me, and it changed like my thought and my views on different things and experiences. And I just feel like going out there and trying to see new things and meet new people and talk to strangers, but maybe not strangers in New York City, because sometimes they can be a little kooky. But, you know, I think there's like a whole world out there, and it's very easy for us to get confined and comfortable in our own little world. And to go out there and explore your passions, or travel and see a new place, or go see a play that you never thought you would enjoy, or read a book that you never thought you'd like. And just taking baby steps to expand your horizons, I think, can sort of spark new motivation and inspiration that you never knew was there in the first place.
Thank you. Sometimes when I ask that question, I get the same reaction that I got from you, the sigh and then like, whoa, that's a big one.
It is a big one.
It is. And over time, you know, people have said to me like, well, what's the context? And it's like, you know what? Somebody walks up to you and just says, hey, I'm not feeling it. Can you help me out? Mm-hmm. And what would you say? So it's kind of, I appreciate the quick response, right? Because you don't have time. And sometimes I tell people, and I don't remember if I told you, that I would ask you something like that. It's a big one. I agree. And I'm kind of happy that I'm the one asking the questions and not answering them.
Well, I appreciate you just listening to me ramble while I was, if you couldn't tell, I was trying to figure out the answer as I was talking. And it's something that's worth reflecting on yourself. So thank you for posing that.
I couldn't tell that you were, as you'd call it, rambling. I just think it's kind of cool to just ask the question, let people talk about it, and just see where it goes. I think those are the best conversations, right? If everything we did was scripted, it'd be so boring.
Very
it'd be like,
true.
Oh, here comes that question. I know exactly what I'm going to say. Like, yeah. To a T, that's boring. That sucks. So I appreciate people coming on and just talking. And even though you might have an idea of where I want to go, it could go in any direction, really. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. And I know my listeners appreciate it, because they've told me, you know, over the past 38 podcasts, that they really love hearing what people have to say. Everybody's slightly different, even if they have a similar twist to what they're doing or what they're about. The responses are always different, and there might be a common thread, but still, it's the perspective of the person. It's the experience of the person who's explaining their position, and it's just, I find it to be wonderful. So thank you for that. It has been a real pleasure having you on the podcast. I'm really happy that we got to connect on my terms this time, like my show, and not on your turf. So I thank you for that. And I hope that you have you enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you, Roland. It's been really great talking with you, and thank you for your thoughtful questions and for the opportunity to participate in your podcast. It's been a blast.
Awesome. We'll be in touch soon.